Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Here are several great comments on JBL's first program on 13 Hours, the inside account of what really happened in Benghazi. Hi, JBL. Great first show on this book. I would like to encourage any of your listeners who may be deterred by the language to push beyond it and read it. I was hesitant as well the first time I came across some swearing, but the account was too compelling and too well written to let it stop me from discovering the truth. It's a very interesting and informative read. I also saw the movie in all of its graphic detail only because I had read the book. When you get a visual of what they went through, it speaks volumes of their bravery and courage. And again, with any war movie, there is a language factor. I agree with you. This has more to do with current American history and radical Islam than African politics. And that is from Regina, Saskatchewan. Here's another one. I just finished listening to the show and wanted to say I am really enjoying the introduction to this book, 13 Hours. Typically, this is not a book I would read, but after listening to the last two shows on this book, I might have to reconsider. I also wanted to thank you for the reminder of what to look for when we are looking to read a new educational book. Bibliographies and indexes are easy to forget, but they are very important to ensure we are reading something that is based on at least truthful facts. Looking forward to the overview on 13 Hours. And that's from Arkansas. So I just wanted to thank you for your input. We certainly love to have comments on JBL. We're not even afraid of negative comments if you want to make some of those as well. But I'll tell you how to submit comments at the end of the program. Over the last several programs, we have been covering an overview of the book. But today, I want to begin our panel discussion of this important book, 13 Hours, The Inside Account of What Really Happened in Benghazi. So with me in the studio today is Abraham Blondeau. Now, some of you are probably familiar with Abraham from the Daily show. But Abraham does teach history here at Imperial Academy, and it's our Imperial Academy is located right here on the Herbert W. Armstrong College campus. So welcome, Abraham.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to it. I think once we're done, the listeners will be happy as well. Well, one of the aspects to this book that I really appreciate is Mitchell Zuckoff's attention to history. But here's why I say that. I was doing some research for the program, and I did find a very interesting internet site, and it's titled Fact and Myth. And here's the facts they check on. They check on facts regarding politics, the economy, the deficit, healthcare, energy policy, and conspiracy theories. So I noticed that they had a special website on Benghazi, and their report on Benghazi is titled The Benghazi Attack Timeline, Facts and Myths. Now, the editors of this site, they do some analysis on what has been said, like on 24-hour news programs. They also get into social media. And what they do is they provide their input or their analysis in terms of what is really fact and what is really myth. And I do think after this American election we just went through, hopefully most Americans now realize that for nearly the whole time we were spread a lot of myth instead of a lot of facts. And so we can't really put a lot of faith in our media, to be honest. And I think this website is actually being nice when they call it myth. They really mean fallacy. Actually, we could get a little stronger. They actually mean falsehood, and we could probably even get even stronger yet. They actually mean lies. And so what are we being lied to about? Now, I've even checked some things, and I'm not being critical of this website, but I've even checked some things, what they said, and I think they're maybe maybe haven't done enough of their own job as well, because I think they have a few myths that they're trying to promote anyway. But I don't want to get into that. But here's what they say. This is their, I think they have it about 11-page report. 8 separate investigations have been concluded. And the summation is the lack of preparation is largely to blame. Here's what they say in the middle of the report. It says these reports do conclude that the State Department could have been far more proactive in beefing up the thin and questionable security at the Benghazi embassy. Now, here's what they say at the end of the report. The end of the report says, in retrospect, it appears pretty obvious that more could have been done to address the thin security at the Benghazi embassy. So I thought that in many ways that they were just right on there. But here's the point that I want to get to is I feel that I can truthfully state that Washington, D.C. leaders in the White House and the State Department, they didn't anticipate what was going to happen in Benghazi. And that's why they weren't prepared. And there is a reason why they weren't prepared. And I really think it gets down to the point is they just didn't know the past history of what had happened in Benghazi. And yet I think Zhdukov, in his prologue, gives us the history. And really, the history was available to them as well. And so if you look at that prologue, and I hope you've read it now and read the book, some people would maybe skip over a prologue or a preface, and hopefully you didn't do that. But in that prologue, it is almost an exact same scenario as to what happened on September 11, 2012. But yet, Zhdukov talks about what happened in a former U.S. diplomatic post in Benghazi, Libya, on June 5, 1967. Now, this date coincided with the Israel's 6-day war with Egypt. And if you've read the prologue, I'll just give you just a real short synopsis, and then we'll get Abraham to weigh in on this with us. But in 1967, we did have a very similar. It was not an embassy. It was like a diplomatic post in Benghazi. And, of course, the 6-day war at that time was with Israel against Egypt. And so on Benghazi radio and TV that morning, there were false news reports circulated that America had provided air support to Israel and that America had bombed Cairo. Now, these were false statements. And essentially what happened is the Benghazians took to the streets. They began rioting, and there were Egyptian workers also in Benghazi at the time. They were building an Olympic stadium. They heard the news. They joined in with the rioting with the Benghazians, and they headed to the U.S. diplomatic post. Now, at that time, there were just 10 diplomatic employees there, 8 men and 2 women. And the post was housed in a former bank building. So it's very similar to the buildings that were in Benghazi in 2012. Now, this was not the most secure place. The Libyan guards assigned to protect the consulate also fled their posts. Again, that happened in 2012. So what happened is the angry and violent mob, they broke windows, they stormed through the front door. The consulate staff was well-armed, but the officer in charge ordered that no one shoot or no one arm themselves and, fight back. So he requested that so that they didn't anger the crowd even more. So essentially what the Americans did is they fought them off with the rifle handles and some axe handles. Then they lobbed tear gas grenades into the mob. So they escaped then to the second floor vault. And when the mob could not reach them, they set the building on fire. And so, again, it's a very, very, they're almost to the exact event. It's almost exactly the same as happened in 212. Now, I just want to give you a few quotes from the prologue. This is page 3. It said, State Department officials in Washington discussed rescue options, including a Marine unit, and using paratroopers. Now, remember, this is from 1967. This is not 2012, but it's going to confuse you because it sounds an awful like 2012. But executing those plans would take more time than the Americans had. Meanwhile, the trapped Americans got sporadic phone calls through to their British counterparts, who had a battalion stationed outside Benghazi under a treaty agreement. They had tried several times, the British soldiers had tried several times to get through, but they could not get through. They were ambushed, and you know, the people in Benghazi wouldn't let them through. So as night approached, there was this garbled message got through to the State Department that if they didn't get help, they were going to be dead. And again, it's so similar to what happened in 2012. So eventually what happened is they were able to call the British again. They begged the Britons to come back, and the British did save the 10 Americans. Now, 45 years later, on September 11th, 2012, the American diplomatic outpost in Benghazi again came under sudden siege by this murderous mob. But in this time, there was no British there to help. So, Abraham, so what do you think? Do you agree with my assessment?
Yes, yeah, I think that's a great overview. And I think it's good to look at that because history rarely gives you a perfect precedent for what happened. And in this case, in 1967, it almost perfectly warns or should have warned the American government of what to expect if you allow American assets in a foreign country to be unprotected and vulnerable. Now, that doesn't happen all the time because people don't riot and protest if they're fearful there will be a reprisal or if the place is heavily fortified or heavily protected. So I think this does show once again that American leadership has a tendency to forget history. And a lot of people have been pointing this out, especially over the past 8 years, how not just in Benghazi, but other world theaters, how American leadership forgets history, they forget the lessons to draw from it. And so a lot of people end up paying sometimes with their lives. And especially in Benghazi here, I mean, to the American government as a whole, it certainly was a loss of prestige, but maybe in their balance of power, it didn't really mean a lot. But to the people on the ground, it sure meant a lot. And it meant a lot of pain and a lot of loss in some families.
You know what? The thing, Abraham, that really kind of just impresses upon me, and I hope all you listeners out there really do read. And I think you even need to study the prologue. I mean, just to, as you read the book, just really get this in your mind that this event happened. And the thing that I feel, again, is, you know, I was raised not to speak against our government or speak against our government leaders. That's just the way I was brought up. But if you read that prologue, and then if you look at the events that we've been dealing with since 9/11, 2001, you would think that American leaders in the White House and in the State Department would have realized that Libya is an historic hotspot of anti-Americanism. And Ambassador Stevens and Ambassador Chris Stevens, he knew that there were Al-Qaeda elements against him. They did not want American democracy in Libya. Why were our leaders so arrogant to think that they could send in someone like Chris Stevens, who really was like diplomatic gold? If you really look at his background and if you look at his history, and we did cover that in a couple programs ago, so you need to read that chapter, which is like his resume. You would think we'd have done more to protect it, but we really didn't do that. There is an article that Gerald Flurry has written, and Mr. Flurry is he's the editor in chief of our Philadelphia Trumpet magazine. He is the presenter of the Key of David program, and of course he's the chancellor of our college here. And he's written a great article called A Law of History. And we can send this to you, and we'll give you how you can, you know, receive this article. But he wrote in this article, A Law of History, he said, "Today we hear many academic voices telling people that learning history is of little or no value. This is an extremely dangerous trend that may be too entrenched ever to correct. The educational plague is rampant among the American and British peoples. It seems that few of our leaders understand what a colossal disaster it is." Now, this article, I'm not going to be able to read all of it to you, but it is really quite interesting. He does talk a lot about Winston Churchill and how Churchill learned from history. But later in the article, Mr. Fleury does talk about we haven't learned from the history of even World War II. We've forgotten it. And I'll just read you this paragraph. It says, "Most people in the 1930s were almost totally unaware of Adolf Hitler's grand design. That is because they were ignorant of Hitler's own history. He had laid out his master plan in his book, Mein Kampf. Around 50 million people were killed in World War II. How many lives could have been saved if we had read and heeded Mein Kampf and then used our power to stop Hitler before he could do such damage?" And so see, this struggle with history has been going on for some time. He goes on in this article, and he says, "Similarly, Osama bin Laden wrote and spoke about he was going to attack and terrorize America. Most of our people ignored his declaration of war, and when he bombed the World Trade Center in 1993, we still didn't know about or believe his threats, even though that was the first time America has ever been attacked by terrorism inside its borders. It wasn't until terrorists struck America on September 11th, 2001, that we finally believed bin Laden's speeches and writings." But he goes on to say, "The great tragedy is that we have learned little, if anything, from the twisted histories of both Hitler or bin Laden." And I do think that this Benghazi incident is a proof of what Mr. Fleury does say in this article. And again, if you would like the article, you can obtain it on going to trumpet.com, and you can just download it for yourself, or you can also request it from that website as well. So I do think that's interesting, and we do have to learn from this. I think one other thing that's very interesting that if I could just get Abraham's attention here is there's a lot of concern out there that it's kind of like this conspiracy, or maybe it's an overblown statement that there was request for help that was denied. And I don't believe that, and I don't think Abraham believes that, and I know we don't believe that here at the trumpet.com or with the Philadelphia Trumpet. And I think it's really really kind of clear. I think this myth and facts, they want to try and absolve the White House and the State Department from denying help to our diplomatic corps in Benghazi. Now, the excuse they say is it was too late to help. And I don't believe you can actually prove that to be legitimate. I do think that even Ambassador Stevens was asking for help. Now, I think Abraham has some facts on that. So what do you think, Abraham?
Yeah, that's a great point to bring up. And there is a lot of facts out there about the calls for help. And while there are conflicting reports, there is quite a bit of evidence to suggest that many different people in Libya did ask for help. And what's interesting, I believe, is that the earliest help that was able to actually get to Libya was after everyone in Libya actually left. So everyone, the CIA staffers, the GRS operators, the body of Chris Stevens and Sean Smith, Tyrone Woods and Glenn Doherty, they're already in Germany by the time the first American response landed in Libya. And I think that's just a good illustrator of how late they were. But there were many instances where they did ask for help. including Chris Stevens himself, asking for extra assistance, extra security, earlier in the year, around August 8th and August 27th. There are emails and cables he sent to Washington warning them about increased violence in Libya. And then on the actual attack itself, as soon as the attack happened, the Washington, D.C. was alerted, but it wasn't until 20 minutes later that the president was notified and briefed. And then around that time, they were trying to mobilize assets to assist, including fighter jets, certain special task force in Europe, specifically designed to counter Islamic terrorism. But by the time they were staged and ready to go, the operators were already leaving from Libya. And so I think the main point to take away from all this, because the CIA agent chief Bob, he asked for help. Scott Wicklund asked for help. Chris Stevens asked for help. Bob Hicks in Libya, he was the one of the main diplomats in Tripoli. He asked for help as well. And I think the main reason why none of that came to pass was because the administration had no strategy or no backup plan to help those people there. If they ran into trouble, they had to fend for themselves. And the U.S. really had no Mediterranean-based strategy where they could mobilize assets to get there in time. So I think people tried to absolve the White House of error by saying, well, the U.S. military, they were out of fueling range or out of range to help them. But that kind of points out the problem. There should have been someone a lot closer to help them.
It is interesting if you want to really follow up in the book. And again, I really do believe Zuckoff worked very hard as a researcher to figure it out. But if you look at page 63, even under the ambassador section of the book, is as Abraham was saying, Ambassador Stevens, he was requesting security all along because he saw the situation deteriorate. And even at the bottom of the page there, it says that from his office in Tripoli, Stevens observed firsthand the deteriorating security situation in Libya during the late spring of 2012. And so it even gets earlier than August, as you were saying. And what he was requesting was, he was requesting MDS teams to stay there with him because Stevens knew that the State Department employees were feeling very insecure. And he did write to the State Department. And here's what he said. Stevens wrote that the State Department personnel would feel much safer if we could keep two MSD teams with us through this period to support our staff and provide a personal detail for me and the deputy chief of mission and any VIP visitors. Now listen to this. The request was denied. Stevens was told because of staffing limitations and other commitments. And so here he put out requests for help very early on. And this is where I get back to this whole idea of history. This was a hot spot. I mean, this was a horrible hot spot. We'd already had 9/11, 2001. I mean, if you go back in history, September 11th is very important to the Islam radicals because that date's important because they lost a war to Europe on the same date, centuries before that. And so it's a very important date. They want to make a statement on this day. And we should know that. And if we're going to send a man, let's say, that is as good as Chris Stevens was, I would think we would have been happy to give him two MDS teams, well, especially when you're sending him into a situation like Benghazi. I mean, it was a very unstable situation. It's really interesting. On page 65, you can see that there was already a travel ban issued in America for Americans not to go to Libya. And so that should have told them that there was real trouble there. In his diary, the night of, I think it was September 11th, he wrote in his diary, he just scratched out that, boy, this, the security situation is getting really bad. So he knew it, and he was trying to get help. Now, unfortunately, as we know, they did a lot of investigation afterwards. And then on page 61 of the book, it does say, a December 12, 2012 government review concluded that the compound included a weak and very extended perimeter, an incomplete interior fence, no man traps, and an unhardened entry gates and doors. Benghazi was also severely under-resourced with regard to weapons, ammunition, non-lethal deterrence, and fire and safety equipment, including escape masks. So here it's like we sent Chris Stevens in there to try and democratize Benghazi, and we had his hands tied behind his back. So that's really what happened. So we're probably out of time for this program. And what I want to do is just tell you that in late December, we will begin JBL's Around the World series. We're going to start with Robert Seethaler's short novel, A Whole Life. It was translated into the English from the German, and it is a heartwarming and heartrending story of a mountain man's life and his view of the world, and it's set in the mid-20th century. So you can order the book from your local bookseller, or you can purchase it online from abebooks.com. Now, if you'd like to write me any comments, and I do invite you to do that, it's so great to have those, you can write me at jbl@pcog.org. You can follow JBL on Twitter at jbliterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. The address is facebook.com/justthebestliterature. Also, if you would like me to send you a copy of Mr. Fleury's article on a law of history, you can also write to me at jbl@pcog.org, and we'll get that sent out to you. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.